Chapter 5. From asking God to change the world to praying that he change us. Jesus said, "Be of good cheer," which is certainly positive. But then he added, "For I have overcome the world." He didn't say, "I have fixed the world," but rather, "I have overcome it." The difference between fixing the world and overcoming it is huge. The problem most of us have is that we try to fix instead of overcoming, which is why we never find that fundamental good cheer. Trying to fix the world is like trying to change a movie by manipulating the movie screen. The world as we know it is simply a screen onto which we project our thoughts. Until we change those thoughts, the movie stays the same. The truth is that our fundamental happiness stems not from anything that happens in the material world, but from love itself. Certainly, there are some wonderful experiences to be had on the material plane, and there's nothing wrong with enjoying them to the fullest. The world itself is neutral. Whether or not something of the material plane can be considered holy is determined by the purposes our mind ascribes to it. That which is used by the Holy Spirit for purposes of genuine healing is holy. That which is used by the ego for purposes of separation is not. The body itself can be a beautiful lesson in communion until communion is, as it says in A Course in Miracles. For wherever there is love, there is God. But we cannot enjoy the material plane if we're overly attached to it. The secret of happiness lies in knowing that we are in the world, but not of it. That understanding, keeping our thoughts on love while having our feet planted squarely on earth, is the intersection between heaven and earth. And that intersecting point is what we are. It is our mission to live on the earth while thinking only the thoughts of heaven. And when we do, the power of the intersecting point between man and God, symbolized visually in both the cross and the Star of David, overcomes all negative force. That is the overcoming to which Jesus referred and that he himself embodied. We pay a high price for refusing to accept the part we play in causing our problems. Because if I don't see I caused it, then I can't see I can change it. But once I'm willing to take total responsibility for my own experience, then I can see the value of inviting the Holy Spirit to enter my mind and fill me with his Spirit. Consciousness precedes form, and perfect form arises from a consciousness of total love. Total love seems like a very tall order until we consider the reality that total love is what we are. So where's the disconnect? We ask, if I'm love, and love creates miracles, then why is my life so screwed up? At a certain level, it's not our reality that's the issue. The issue is how much of our reality we allow ourselves to experience and express. In the introduction to A Course in Miracles, it stated, "This course does not aim at teaching the meaning of love, for that is beyond what can be taught. It does aim, however, at removing the blocks to your awareness of love's presence, which is your natural inheritance." Love is all around us, but we're in the mental and emotional habit of deflecting it. With every attitude of attack or defense, we send love away. With every perception of anyone's guilt, we tell love to leave. With every thought of limited possibility, we tell miracles we don't want them, and then we wonder why we're depressed. In order to truly treat the depression, we must ask ourselves essential questions. What am I doing or not doing to allow fear rather than love to prevail here? Who am I attacking or not forgiving? What am I myself not giving to this situation? According to A Course in Miracles, we achieve so little because we have undisciplined minds. We indulge our fear as if we're being strong to do so, honest in a way that makes us more real. What is so real about playing weak instead of strong? Sometimes we need to tell our fear to go to hell, which is literally where it came from. The ego is backed by the weight of an entire thought system, constantly luring us away from love and limitlessness toward fear and scarcity. It is a vicious taskmaster, and it has our hearts, indeed our entire planet, in its grip. And according to A Course in Miracles, some people would rather die than change their minds. The transformation of the heart will take more than an intellectual decision. The ego is a mental addiction to the thinking of fear, and only a spiritual experience can break an addiction. If we want our lives and our world to genuinely change, then we need a spiritual experience to make it happen. And in order to have that experience, we must open our hearts to receive it. Trusting the process. What an amazing thought that ever unfolding good is actually the natural order of the universe, and that we were created to enjoy it. To the ego, that is a preposterous notion. It would have us believe that joy is something lovely to be outgrown. But look at small children gleefully at play. Do we know something they don't know? Or do they perhaps know something we've forgotten? As I listen to my teenage daughter discuss love and relationships, I remember how it was for me when I was her age. And I don't look back on my earliest forays into romance and think, oh, but that was only puppy love. Rather, I look back and think how courageously we loved before we knew what there was to be afraid of. How strong we were before any other agenda stood in the way of our love. And how pure our hearts were when they were not yet tainted by cynicism or doubt. The older we are, the more we know some things, and the younger we are, the more we know others. Age only makes us smarter if we retain our bravery. Enlightenment is not a learning, but an unlearning, a letting go of all the fears we've gathered as we've walked the path of life. As it states in A Course in Miracles, miracles are everyone's right, but purification is necessary first. Purification is the process by which everything but love dissolves from our mind. As we drop the layers of fear and illusion that have hardened around our psyches, we are left with the love with which we were endowed at our creation. Just as embryonic cells are programmed to develop into a baby, each of us is programmed to develop a more magnificent life. An invisible hand guides the embryo and guides you and me as well. But unlike the embryo, you and I can refuse it. God didn't create us as babies and then just drop us here and say, okay, kid, now you're on your own. But how do we know that if we're not taught to listen to our hearts? Why would we go with the flow if we don't know such a flow exists? And so we keep going around saying no to life and then wonder why life seems to be saying no to us. The Divine Physician. God knows our crooked places that need to be made straight, the wounds in our hearts that fester for years unhealed, the broken places in our lives that seem beyond repair. And He who is the author of miracles has infinite desire as well as power to heal them all. So if that's the case, then why so much pain? Could it be that the doctor has the medicine, but the patient refuses to take it? According to A Course in Miracles, God cannot take away from us that which we do not release to Him. It's not enough to understand your problem, to say, my mother made me feel unsafe when I was a child, so that's the way I react the way I do. Rather, we need to say, dear God, I know I react this way. Please change me. And that's an important difference. At a certain point, it doesn't really matter so much how we got to be a certain way. Until we admit our character defects and take responsibility for the fact that regardless of where we got them, they're ours now. God Himself has no power to heal them. We can talk to a therapist for hours about how it was our relationship with our mother or our father that made us develop a certain behavioral characteristic, but that of itself will not make it go away. Naming it, surrendering it to God, and asking Him to remove it, that's the miracle of personal transformation. It won't go away in a moment necessarily, but its days are numbered. The medicine is in your psychic bloodstream. Sometimes, therefore, the healing process involves our having to take a good look in the mirror before we can do anything else. You might pray for a better job situation, and the next thing you know, you experience your biggest professional disaster yet. It might look like when you prayed, things only got worse. But what actually happened is that you were moved subconsciously to create a situation in which your own weakness was on display, magnified enough for you to get a very good look at it. Things, in fact, did not get worse. You were simply no longer anesthetized to your own experience and the part you played in creating it. And that's why we pushed so many issues to the back of the drawer to begin with, so we wouldn't have to endure the pain of genuine self-examination. We're afraid of an ugliness we feel is lurking inside us, but in fact, what we fear is an illusionary self. This illusion exudes a continuous toxicity if it remains in the dark, yet disappears the moment it's exposed to light. The ego is dispersed into nothingness when released into the hands of God. The ego is not where we're bad, but where we're wounded. Yet often we don't want to take a good look at our wounds, much less let God look with us, because we're ashamed. No one expects a wound on the body to be pretty. We're not ashamed of the blood and gore that accompany a physical wound. Yet we're embarrassed that we have emotional wounds. Our emotional and psychological wounds often appear not as places where we are hurt, but rather as places where we're guilty. Our spiritual wounds take the form of character defects. So we often try to hide who we are rather than heal who we are. We're afraid that if we show our true selves, something ugly will appear. Only when we realize who lives within us do we see that only beauty will appear. In the meantime, our wounds fester untended until surrendered for divine healing. Our denial or unwillingness to look deeply at our own issues reflects a naive hope that if we don't look at our wounds, they'll go away by themselves. It takes emotional courage to look deeply into ourselves and face what's there. Until we do, however, God's medicine can't heal us. Until you understand that God is your healer and not your judge, it's unlikely you will go to Him with your pain. It's understood we take our clothes off if the doctor needs to check us, but we're afraid to present ourselves naked before God. Until we make the switch from the notion of an angry, judgmental God to an all-merciful and forgiving one, we're bound to have an ambivalent relationship to Him. Who wants to admit a mistake to someone they think will judge them for it? We've created a God in our own image, angry and judgmental, because we are. God Himself is merciful and all-loving, but we have projected onto Him our fear. This separates us both from His love, from His healing, and from each other. When we change our perception from a God of wrath to a God of mercy, we will realize God is a divine physician. Our pain is the pain of hell or separation from love. It isn't God who sends us to hell for being bad. It's God who delivers us from hell after the ego told us we're bad. Hell is when you think you're a terrible person and you never do anything right. God is the one who reminds you of the innocence in which you were created and to which He will help you return. Hell is when you feel you're a complete and utter failure who will never succeed. God is the one who reminds you that He lives within you, and in Him all things are possible. Hell is when you think you can never escape your past mistakes. God is the one who makes all things new. It is the ego, not God, who casts us into the quote-unquote fires of hell. It is God who lifts us out of them.